the same preachers who fired up the Taliban. American forces deployed near the Pakistan border could see clearly that Frontier Corps soldiers waved small Taliban units into Afghanistan or ignored them. Yet given the weakness of Pakistani institutions, Barno and his military intelligence analysts at ISAF assessed, this was not decisive evidence of Pakistani state policy. They thought, well, these guys are probably cousins. To Zalmay Khalilzad, the essential questions were, is a sanctuary being developed by the Taliban inside Pakistan? And, if so, did this have Musharraf's endorsement? He concluded that Pakistan's double game was undeniable. The raw intelligence he relied upon included NDS and CIA agent reporting about training areas on Pakistani territory and Taliban graduation ceremonies where ISI officers were reportedly present. Of course, the agent reports could always be discounted as unreliable. Khalilzad credited the intelligence overall, however, and assumed Musharraf had to have endorsed such support. Can this happen without his knowledge? He asked. Why is he doing it? The U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, Nancy J. Powell, a career Foreign Service officer who had served half a dozen tours in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, argued that Khalilzad's pressure campaign against Musharraf was misplaced. The struggle between the two ambassadors played out in what became known to participants as the War of the No-Dis Cables, meaning cables not to be distributed through wide channels. They exchanged a stream of invective, some of it in cables, more of it in email and direct phone conversations. Besides Powell, Khalilzad also sometimes got into it with Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. The essential subject was whether the United States was being fooled by Pakistan. Powell's superiors at State had instructed her before she departed for Islamabad not to get into cabling wars with the U.S. embassies in Kabul and India over ISI's conduct or other sources of controversy about Pakistan. But Khalilzad raised the temperature. In one cable, Powell felt that he had attempted to question her loyalty and patriotism, simply because she had tried to describe Pakistan's position of relative weakness in relation to the Taliban, and the fact that the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan has never, ever been controlled. She argued that Khalilzad had exaggerated Musharraf's ability to control everything in Pakistan and everyone in it, especially in the federally administered tribal areas. Khalilzad blamed her unfairly simply for reporting on Pakistan's outlook, she believed. Yet she did have a cautious view of what the facts had established about Directorate S activity. To be sure, Powell felt, there were military officers with mixed loyalties, yet there was never a clear connection between the government of Pakistan and support for those groups. She did not regard Musharraf as especially trustworthy, but the United States had other interests in Pakistan. If they went hard after ISI, especially without great evidence, it would disrupt her embassy's mission to try to work with Pakistan on controlling its nuclear weapons, reducing tensions with India over Kashmir, and supporting the country's economic and social development. For his part, Khalilzad thought he understood why Pakistan might be preparing the Taliban for a return to Afghanistan. Musharraf and his high command had concluded that the United States would leave the region. They had good reason. As it became mired in Iraq, the Bush administration signaled openly that it wanted European countries to take the lead in Afghanistan. Pakistan's generals assumed that, without a U.S. military commitment, Afghanistan would fall apart again. Pakistani generals, including Musharraf, concluded, they had better have some of their own horses. Musharraf seemed to confirm as much in an interview years later. As president of Pakistan, he said he would ask American visitors, are you leaving a stable Afghanistan or not? If not, then I have to think of my own security. If you leave without that, I am thinking of 1989 or 1996, two pivot points of civil war in Afghanistan. In both cases, ISI-backed Islamist Afghan factions aligned with Islamabad's interests and opposed to India. In December 2003, Al-Qaeda-linked Pakistani assassins rammed two car bombs into Musharraf's convoy as he rode through Rawalpindi. He narrowly escaped death. It turned out that one of the suicide bombers was an ISI-backed militant who had fought in Kashmir. A second bombing attempt by the same network followed in April. Musharraf fired an ISI general in charge of the Kashmir cell of Directorate S and ordered Pakistani troops into South Waziristan to attack Al-Qaeda and its local allies. He allowed CIA officers and special forces to embed with Pakistani units and continued to cooperate with CIA drone operations, including, for the first time, lethal strikes carried out against Taliban leaders in South Waziristan. To President Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell, that Al-Qaeda tried to kill Musharraf and that the Pakistan army moved into Waziristan to retaliate seemed to make plain that Pakistan was on America's side. It did not compute for them that Musharraf might be simultaneously at war with Al-Qaeda and promoting the Taliban. To try to resolve the dispute between the embassies in Kabul and Islamabad, Stephen Hadley, Condoleezza Rice's deputy at the National Security Council, ordered an intelligence review of the Taliban's revival during 2003 and 2004. Yet the CIA could not definitively resolve exactly how the Taliban had constructed a sanctuary in Pakistan or the role of ISI there. Paid agents run by NDS would report something along the lines of, Mullah Abdullah's house is in the third street to the right, off the main road, in the old city of Quetta. But there were not many fixed street addresses in Quetta. The CIA ordered satellite photography of the city. CIA officers from Islamabad station also visited Quetta with ISI escorts to try to obtain a sense of its warrens firsthand. Even so, when imagery analysts looked at photos or Predator video to try to confirm specific NDS reporting about Taliban addresses, they could discern little. Or it would turn out that a reported address was actually a mosque where Taliban turned up from time to time. The CIA proved unable to place reliable, unilateral American agents in Quetta to nail down addresses of senior Taliban leaders. Fugitive hunting in hostile, denied areas was one of the most challenging tasks case officers undertook. Definitive proof of ISI activity in such a scenario required matching signals intelligence, overhead photography, and agent reporting on the ground. The CIA never got the complete triangulation of information, SIGINT, and everything, an official involved recalled. Quetta remained a black hole. Zalmay Khalilzad just didn't believe Musharraf's claims. In Washington for consultations, he made headlines during a talk at a think tank by declaring openly that Pakistan was providing sanctuary to the Taliban. In the Oval Office, President Bush told Khalilzad, "Musharraf denies all of what you are saying." "Didn't they deny, Mr. President, for years that they had a nuclear program?" Bush said he would call Musharraf and arrange for the ambassador to meet with him to discuss the accusations directly. Khalilzad flew to Islamabad. Beforehand, he sent Musharraf a gift, a crate of Afghan pomegranates. When they sat down, Musharraf thanked him, but added that he hated pomegranates. Too many seeds. They talked extensively about Musharraf's usual complaints about the Afghan government. Too many panjaris in key security positions, too many Indian spies under diplomatic cover in Kabul and elsewhere. Khalilzad proposed a joint intelligence investigation between the United States and Pakistan to document any covert Indian activity in Afghanistan. "There are no Taliban here," Musharraf said blankly. Douglas Porch grew up in the South, served in the U.S. Army Reserves, and then, in the late 1960s, enrolled at Cambridge University, where he earned a doctoral degree in history. He wrote several books about France's brutal expeditionary wars in Algeria, Indochina, and the Sahara. French officers were the first to identify counterinsurgency as a separate category of warfare. After 1840, to suppress the Algerian leader Abdelkader, who, like Mullah Muhammad Omar, called himself the Commander of the Faithful, French forces under the command of Thomas Robert Bugeaud burned crops, orchards, and villages. They incinerated civilians who hid from them in caves. These horrors provoked opposition at home, and so gradually the military repackaged counterinsurgency as a civilizing mission, as Porch put it. This included an assumption of Arab racial inferiority. Phrases like hearts and minds first arose in public discourse in the 1890s. The French called the strategy peaceful penetration. By the 1960s, counterinsurgency had evolved into a more technocratic modernization theory in some quarters of the West. Kennedy-era national security intellectuals argued that as the United States fought for free societies in the face of Soviet communism, it had an obligation to protect emerging states as they evolve to become functional capitalist economies, in Porch's summary. That doctrine influenced America's fateful decision to accept France's legacy in Vietnam. In early 2004, Porch was teaching military history at the Naval War College in Rhode Island. His students were captains, majors, and lieutenant commanders. Armed pacification campaigns by foreign forces only rarely persuaded locals of the interveners' good intentions, he believed. Porch later authored a contrarian book titled Counterinsurgency, exposing the myths of the new way of war. Yet such campaigns did not always fail. In 2004, the Afghan War looked to Porch as if it was going pretty well. Perhaps this would be an exception to military history's general rule. That winter, he took a phone call from an officer at Joint Special Operations Command. Major General Stanley McChrystal, JSOC's commander, now shuttled between two clandestine task force headquarters, one in Iraq and the other in Afghanistan. Every quarter, he called his commanding officers to a conference. The JSOC officer asked Porch if he could talk to the group about Algeria, and specifically, the Battle of Algiers, the 1966 film depicting France's urban war against Algerian revolutionaries seeking independence. The film credibly showed both sides of the conflict. Could Porch lecture on the movie and lead a discussion about what French counterinsurgency history might imply for fighting the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Come to Fort Bragg, the JSOC officer added, but bring things, because the talk probably won't be in Fort Bragg. He did not mention an alternative site, but he suggested, bring jeans and athletic shoes. Porch was then 59 years old. JSOC set him up for shots, fitted him with a flak jacket. The next thing he knew, he was at Bagram Air Base. JSOC units lived and worked on Zulu, or Greenwich Mean Time. They had breakfast at noon local time and went to bed at about 3 a.m., a strange rhythm for a visitor to follow. Bagram remained primitive, covered with detritus from the Soviet War. The Americans lived in tents and plywood shacks. McChrystal summoned Porch after midnight. The general lived a famously Spartan existence, sharing a hutch with his sergeant major. He explained that for his conference, in addition to screening the Battle of Algiers, he had assigned his commanding officers to read Modern Warfare, a book written in 1964 by Roger Tranquier, a French officer who served in Vietnam and Algeria. McChrystal was trying to provoke his commanders, door-kickers, shooters, terrorist hunters by training and vocation, to think more carefully about what kind of wars they had fallen into. He felt his operations were very tactical. The standard procedure was, give me a list of the bad guys and I'm going to go find them. Now, culling alone looked insufficient. Iraq was falling apart, and the violence in that theater was much worse than anything his superiors in Washington were willing to acknowledge. In Afghanistan, McChrystal thought the Taliban had started to get their feet under them, and there were indications that they were moving out. He told Porch, "We don't know what the hell is going on out there, beyond the wire of their bases. It's quiet. One problem, McChrystal believed, was that special operations units lacked a common understanding of how to fight without making the insurgencies worse. Again and again, he heard, we have got to take the gloves off. McChrystal asked, what are you talking about? What do we mean here? He wanted his officers to reflect on experiences like those the French had endured in Vietnam and Algeria, where they had already documented what works and what doesn't work. David Barno, McChrystal's West Point classmate and his counterpart in command of conventional forces, harbored parallel worries. His forces were on sprawling bases and routinely prepared for large two-week operations with names like Operation Mountain Thunder. They would tromp around in the nether regions, as Barno put it. It was effectively sticking your fist in a bucket of water and pulling it back out again. He had read counterinsurgency literature, too, and wanted to apply its theories and lessons in Afghanistan, even though he commanded nowhere near the number of troops that counterinsurgency doctrine dictated would be necessary to suppress the enemy. Barno focused his effort on small provincial reconstruction teams centered on the population and equipped to deliver aid and build local relationships. On a Friday night, about 20 JSOC commanders and an equal number of senior non-commissioned officers assembled around plywood tables arranged in the hollow square. Porch delivered a lecture about the hard lessons of French Expeditionary War and the Algerian War for Independence. One of his PowerPoint slides showed an old photo of suspected terrorists kneeling on the ground, tied together at the neck with rope. A portion of the French army lost its moral compass, Porch's headline noted. In the film, he previewed, the French counterinsurgency officer justifies exceptional measures in counterterrorism. In your view, are his the arguments of a soldier? Porch asked. The next night, they watched the Battle of Algiers, and afterward Porch led a discussion. The film contained repulsive scenes of French forces torturing insurgent suspects, but it showed that brutality could destroy an uprising, even if the long-term goal of control and stability might be futile. As they talked, there were some JSOC operators who remained focused on the core mission, Al-Qaeda. We're going to get bin Laden and hang him up by the balls, as Porch put it. But others, particularly the younger non-commissioned officers, picked up on the idea that there had to be more to success in this age of saturated media and global human rights consciousness than just capture and kill. Porch stayed on at Bagram for another 10 days, waiting for a flight out. He befriended a military lawyer who took him over to the airfield's detention center, situated in old Soviet aircraft hangars. The interrogators Porch met complained that they had little good intelligence about the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and that 10th Mountain Division units detained Afghans for spurious reasons. Well, he has new shoes. He must be an insurgent. To Porch, it all sounded like the French in Algeria and Vietnam. You just pick up every military-aged male you can find. The detention center was an enormous open space with balconies that ran around the top. On the second level were interrogation rooms. The detained men were held in a big cage at the bottom, exposed. A curtain shielded toilets. Many of the American guards were female. When they escorted prisoners to the interrogation rooms, they shackled, handcuffed, and hooded them. Porch reflected on the humiliation the Afghan prisoners must be experiencing. Porch asked if he could visit Kabul. His hosts told him, no, it's too dangerous. He flew home and returned to the classroom at the Naval War College. Over the next several years, his students included young officers rotating back from Afghanistan and Iraq. Gradually, it became obvious that both wars were deteriorating and that American forces struggled to win the loyalty of the populations they policed. An army major told Porch, you start out being nice to them, but as soon as we lose a couple of men, the gloves come off. By the spring of 2004, it was evident that the Iraq War's casus belli had been grounded in false intelligence reporting about Saddam Hussein's possession of biological and nuclear weapons. Press leaks from the White House fingered George Tenet's CIA for this embarrassment. Press leaks from the CIA emphasized that the Bush administration had interfered with pre-war intelligence. Bush faced re-election in November. It was obvious who would win this fight. Tenet had by now run the CIA for almost 7 years, the second longest tenure in the agency's history, after that of Alan Dulles during the 1950s. On June 3, 2004, he resigned. His departure inaugurated 2 years of turmoil on the seventh floor. Bush appointed Porter Goss as his successor. He was a former CIA case officer who led the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence as a Republican member of Congress. Even as one of the top congressional overseers of the agency, Goss had no idea that Tenet was about to go, and was surprised when Bush asked him to take charge of Langley. To succeed Buzzy Krongard as executive director, Goss appointed Kyle Dusty Fargo. A year later, Fargo was indicted for his role in corrupt contracting deals carried out while he held office at the CIA. Mike Sulick and Steve Kappas, senior intelligence service veterans who then ran the clandestine service, resigned in late 2004 after a fight with another Goss aide. The Goss team had arrived in a heavy-handed state of suspicion, they felt, asking for lists of officers who were acceptable, accusing senior officers of leaking unflattering stories and of being politicized. Sulick told one of Goss's aides, "You're not going to treat us the way you treated the Democrats on the Hill, like pukes." After the two quit on principle, Goss persuaded Jose Rodriguez, the architect of the interrogation black sites and enhanced interrogation techniques, to run clandestine operations. At CTC, Goss elevated Michael D'Andrea, a dark-tempered, chain-smoking convert to Shia Islam, who had most recently served as chief of station in Cairo. This group portrait of leadership had some of the roughest edges yet. Goss hadn't asked for the job. As he settled in on the seventh floor, he concluded that he had inherited a troubled agency. He knew for certain, from his own experience in the House of Representatives, that there was little trust between the CIA and Capitol Hill, primarily because of the Iraq fiasco. Some Republican congressmen suspected Tenet of betraying Bush. Democrats opposed to the Iraq War were at the same time appalled and furious over the role of bad intelligence in the run-up to the invasion. Goss took it on himself to try to restore decent relations and win increases in funding from Congress, particularly to support expansion in the number of case officers and stations overseas. His marching orders from George W. Bush were to strengthen the CIA's ability to collect intelligence abroad and to adapt to the challenges of collecting insights on terrorists and guerrillas. Rebuilding a sense of confidence on the Hill was a bitter pill for some career CIA officers to swallow. Goss's decision to bring Hill staff with him rather than draw his new executive team from CIA career personnel redoubled his burdens. He also felt that the agency had changed in unfortunate ways since his days as a case officer in the 1960s. Overall, there was a loss of discipline, he sensed, manifested in leaks to the press and a lack of accountability in the chain of command. He wanted to restore accountability, but he underestimated how difficult it would be for an outsider from Capitol Hill to succeed. Early in 2004, the CIA produced a breakthrough about Al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Pakistan's federally administered tribal areas. In January, Kurdish forces captured Hassan Gul, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant. They transferred him to CIA custody. He carried a notebook full of coded phone numbers and email addresses. Gul translated the codes for his captors. He explained that Al-Qaeda had established safe houses around Wana and the Shikai Valley in South Waziristan. Leaders of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan operated from both places. This was the same area from which the assassins who had attempted to blow up President Musharraf had emerged. the Bush administration perceived a fresh opportunity to collaborate with Pakistan. Rather than following Zalmay Khalilzad's advice to pressure Musharraf over ISI's relationship with the Taliban, the administration adopted something like the opposite policy. It offered more financial aid to Pakistan's military regime. The White House announced that it would confer on Pakistan the status of major non-NATO ally and deliver $700 million in fresh assistance, more than half of it for the military. Musharraf ordered the Pakistan Army to step up its operations in South Waziristan, where he had already sent 8,000 troops. Musharraf and Bush agreed to quietly set up a special operations task force to attack militants in the tribal areas. The United States supplied helicopters with precision weapons and night operating capability, in Musharraf's description. The campaign's tactics reflected Musharraf's neo-colonial attitude toward Waziristan's Pashtuns. The only way to get their attention, he told the Americans repeatedly, was to hit the tribes ruthlessly. The CIA's main target that spring was a long-haired, charismatic militant leader of the Wazirs named Nek Mohammed. He ruled Wana and distrusted the Pakistan army. He was a complicated figure, a tribal nationalist who consorted with international terrorists. He accepted Al-Qaeda and Uzbek refugees. In Islamabad, CIA Station Chief Rich Blee used the assassination attempts against Musharraf to try to motivate the president and ISI to strike back. "You have to kill them, or they're going to kill us." The CIA and the Omega teams based just across the Afghan border, at Shkin and Khost, tracked Nek Mohammed to target him for a drone strike. They worked with Task Force Orange, a National Security Agency signals intelligence unit. The manhunt took place amid a wider, violent Pakistani campaign against Nek Mohammed's Wazir supporters. The Omega base at Shkin lay less than 2 miles from the Pakistani border. At night, operators and case officers would sit up on a roof, smoke cigars, and watch Pakistani F-16s bomb Wana, often indiscriminately. The Pakistanis closed the town's bazaar, and refugees from what was already a deeply impoverished population began to walk into Afghanistan to escape the violence and beg for food. Case officers recruited agents from among the locals and sent them back into Waziristan to pinpoint Al-Qaeda facilities. These sorts of intelligence operations turned ugly and cost indigenous agents their lives. The CIA lost a lot of sources to the Taliban, to a rival family, recalled a participant. Junior Pentagon and CIA case officers, under weak supervision, would hand out Thuraya satellite phones and GPS location loggers to local Pashtuns to record the exact longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates of safe houses so the targets could be struck by drone missiles or smart bombs. But walking around with a GPS logger in that region was itself a death warrant. The Pakistan Army suffered similar agent losses. The Taliban went witch-hunting for American and ISI spies, according to Major General Amir Faisal Alavi, who then commanded the Special Services Group, the commando unit that collaborated with the CIA and Special Forces. Corpses of suspected spies began to turn up all over Waziristan, with their throats slit and a note in Pashto attached to their bodies, explaining that the person had been caught, tried, proved to be a spy. That spring, Musharraf agreed to strike the hundreds of Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants gathered in Shikai Valley. Drone photography showed training camps, people shooting, according to a senior intelligence official in the region. The CIA briefed ISI counterparts and placed small teams with Pakistani special forces in Waziristan. The CIA officers carted around compact discs containing classified predator footage approved for sharing with ISI officers to educate them about its potential to take out individuals and small groups with Hellfire missiles. From these discussions in the first half of 2004 arose the secret bargain on drone operations that would color U.S.-Pakistani relations for the next decade. Musharraf allowed the CIA to operate drones armed with Hellfires in designated sections of the tribal areas. The CIA agreed to deny that Musharraf had authorized any such thing. Musharraf argued, "Give the drones to Pakistan." But the CIA refused him on this. The technology was too sensitive. Musharraf then proposed that the agency paint a couple of drones in Pakistan Air Force colors and go on operating as before, unilaterally. At least then he could more credibly claim that he was in charge. Again, the Americans refused. Both sides still agreed that they wanted Nek Mohammed dead. Not everyone on the American side thought this was a great idea. Assassinating a charismatic indigenous Wazir leader would mark a turn away from counterterrorism operations against Al-Qaeda into counterinsurgency against locally credible leaders, with unpredictable consequences. Perhaps it would be better to try to co-opt Mohammed to work with the Americans. Yet the predominant view among senior decision-makers at the CIA and in the American military was that the target was an Al-Qaeda ally who posed a direct threat. Musharraf was delivering just the sort of risk-taking conventional military operations in Waziristan that the Americans demanded. Nek Mohammed's tradecraft was poor. On July 17, 2004, as he talked on a satellite telephone, which he used to give radio interviews, and which could be easily traced by the likes of Task Force Orange, a CIA-operated Predator launched a Hellfire missile from the skies above and killed him. 3 months later, on October 9th, more than 8 million Afghans poured from their homes to cast ballots for president and dip their fingers in a pot of ink to confirm their act of civic participation. The ink was supposed to be indelible to prevent fraud, but it washed off easily. That glitch was not enough to call the election's legitimacy into serious question or to undermine the festival of national restoration the day of voting seemed to create. 70% of registered voters turned out, more than in American presidential elections. Hamid Karzai prevailed against 17 competitors, winning 55% of the reported vote. It was the first direct presidential election in Afghan history. When the final tally was confirmed early in November, Karzai appeared in an illuminated garden at the presidential palace. "These votes are for stability," he said. "We hope with great love and friendship to help the Afghan people." His magnanimity extended to the United States. Without the backing of the Bush administration, and without Khalilzad's intense partnership during the previous 2 years, the outcome might have been different. When Americans visited from Washington now, Karzai made frequent reference to his fondness for the U.S. and Afghanistan's reliability as a partner in the war on terror, one note-taker recorded. He spoke warmly about visiting his brother in Maryland, and his pleasure driving himself, without an entourage and security, and enjoying coffee at Starbucks, as well as his enjoyment of country music in Nashville. As it turned out, this would be the high point of mutual regard between Karzai and America. Karzai and Khalilzad looked for factions of the Taliban and other armed opposition that might be persuaded to reconcile with the government. The election triumph created a new opportunity. Sections of Hizb-e-Islami, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's party, had decided to enter politics. Hekmatyar, who had taken refuge in Iran and then returned to Afghanistan and Pakistan, remained at large, operating an armed wing of his movement. Hekmatyar's allies worked out a deal and entered parliament in Kabul. Zalmay Khalilzad sought new instructions from the Bush White House about terms for talking to the Taliban. The Afghan interagency group met to write an updated policy. American diplomats had talked with Taliban officials throughout the 1990s. The NSC reviewed that history and now emphasized that any Taliban defector who wanted to avoid being sent to Guantanamo had to renounce Al-Qaeda and be cleared of past involvement in terrorism. A few former Taliban did move to Kabul. In May 2005, however, Zalmay Khalilzad left to become ambassador to Iraq. Khalilzad was uniquely suited to defection talks with fellow Afghans. The momentum halted. Barno departed too, a month later. He felt there was a lost opportunity, after the election, to bring in larger numbers of the Taliban. Yet it did not seem a decisive failure at the time. When they left, he and Khalilzad both thought, the Taliban are on the ropes, they were politically crushed by the election, this whole effort is on a success glide slope. They both felt really, really good. The CIA, too, underestimated the Taliban's potential to regenerate. Partly this was because agency analysis concentrated on Al-Qaeda. The CIA's analysts were also guilty in the first years after the Taliban's fall of a kind of culture of self-censorship, according to Paul Miller, an analyst at the Directorate of Intelligence, because they were reluctant to deliver bad news to the Bush White House. They feared that if their reporting on the early signs of the Taliban's revival was interpreted as criticism of Bush administration policy, its skepticism about Afghan nation-building, for example, then the White House might stop listening to the CIA. Even when the evidence of trouble became harder to ignore, there was a culture of optimism about Afghanistan across the administration. Whenever somebody would say, things are getting worse, someone else would point out that the economy was growing, a new constitution was in place, they had just held a successful election, and, in any event, Iraq is going much, much worse. Chapter 12. Digging a Hole in the Ocean. Early in 2006, Ashfaq Kayani flew to Bagram Airfield on an unannounced visit. Kayani's place as Musharraf's most trusted and powerful lieutenant was by now ratified. He had been promoted to Director General of Inter-Services Intelligence. The sergeant's son and muddy boots career officer now wore civilian suits at the whitewashed, manicured ISI compound in Islamabad. His responsibilities encompassed the tribal areas, domestic politics, Baluch separatism, and ISI platforms for anti-Indian operations such as Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Thailand. Hardly a week passed without the Americans pressing onto his agenda. As a young officer, Kayani had smoked cigarettes, but he had given them up. The stress of running ISI brought him back to the habit. He now chain-smoked, placing his Dunhills in a stemmed holder, which made him look like an eccentric British actor from the 1950s. Between his mumble and the clouds of smoke enshrouding him, he seemed well-suited to the role of spymaster. The CIA sought to promote greater cooperation between ISI and Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security. Rich Blee was one of the architects of the effort. He had a great fondness for both countries. He was among the Bush administration's South Asia hands who retained a hope that ISI and NDS had common interests in containing extremism and promoting stability. One problem was that Pakistan's generals regarded NDS as a hostile force, with a director, Amrullah Saleh, whom they assessed to be an ally, if not an agent, of India. Saleh regarded himself as an ardent Afghan nationalist, and certainly not an agent of any foreign power. He worked with India, sometimes closely, among many other allies of an independent Afghanistan, including the United States. Blee and others at CIA respected Saleh and felt they could talk with him logically about anything, except ISI. Saleh would present a dossier of evidence that asserted something like, Colonel Muhammad is the Quetta Shura's contact at ISI. The CIA would run it by their ISI counterparts, who would reply, We have 1,000 Colonel Muhammads. It was an objective fact that the Pakistani service had arrested and handed over hundreds of foreign Al-Qaeda, many more than NDS had collared. Wasn't that evidence of some good faith? Saleh, however, had been accumulating files and addresses of Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders hiding in Pakistan. He placed Pashto-speaking agents into the Taliban's recruiting stream, and chronicled changes in their salaries and training. He paid watchers to patrol the streets of Quetta and Peshawar, to map the homes, mosques, businesses, and families of exiled Taliban commanders. When the NDS caught would-be suicide attackers and assassins inside Afghanistan, the service exploited their cell phone records to trace support networks in Pakistan. Occasionally, Saleh would share with ISI suspect cell phone numbers. Invariably, within a day or two, the numbers went dead, he told colleagues. Saleh found the CIA's deference to ISI and Musharraf highly frustrating. At one point during 2006, the United States had decided to build a new undeclared airstrip in Paktia province, Afghanistan, near the Pakistan border, to facilitate reconnaissance operations. Crews hauled in bulldozers, metal sheeting, and other materials, but when Pakistan discovered the project, its generals demanded that it be shut down. The Americans complied. Because it was too much trouble to haul the equipment out, they bombed their own machinery so the Taliban could not steal it. At Bagram, the idea was that Saleh and Kayani would exchange details about Al-Qaeda and its allies. Detainees in NDS custody had reported taking instructions in Mansehra, a mountain valley town in western Pakistan. Some even suggested bin Laden might be hiding there. Saleh briefed Kayani on his intelligence. "Which house?" the Pakistani spy chief asked. "You'll have to do the last 100 yards yourself," Saleh answered. "This is unbelievable," Kayani said, meaning the NDS reporting was not credible. Saleh said he would offer access to his source if Kayani agreed to work with the CIA on the matter. "Are you telling me you are spying in my country?" "Yes." Kayani was furious. "I don't need to be taught intelligence by someone the age of my son," he said, in Saleh's account. The general went outside for a smoke. The ISI chief struggled to last an hour in any meeting if smoking was not allowed. He returned after he had cooled down. He said he hadn't meant his comment as an insult. He asked Saleh to invite him to his home in Panjshir. Saleh demurred. He was tired of hearing the Pakistanis always name him in reference to his home province. That Panjshiri seemed intended as a slur. He knew how hostile many Afghans were to ISI. "Mr. Director," he told Kayani, "you can't imagine how sensitive people are in regards to Pakistan." The Taliban were clearly on the march in 2006. The number of security incidents in Afghanistan documented by the United Nations grew tenfold between 2003 and the end of 2006. As the head of NDS, Saleh was obligated to investigate the Taliban's bases in Pakistan. "Don't get caught," Saleh's colleagues at the CIA urged him. Saleh decided that spring to conduct a more formal study of the Taliban's resurgence, to inform Karzai, his cabinet, and allies of Afghanistan, including the Bush administration. He wanted to interview active Taliban field commanders personally. There were few impermeable lines in Afghanistan's internal conflicts. Saleh traveled to Zabul, Uruzgan, Helmand, Kandahar, and other provincial capitals. His colleagues in regional NDS offices negotiated safe passage agreements with Taliban commanders, who came in to talk with him. This sometimes involved paying the Taliban for their time and insights. Saleh sat with enemy commanders for long hours. His classified paper, completed in May 2006, was titled Strategy of the Taliban. Saleh regarded Pakistan as an India-centric country, one that had never been Afghanistan-centric. He concluded, based on the limited circumstantial and hard evidence available, that ISI had made a decision in 2005 to support the Taliban more actively, with cash and other aid, backed by covert subsidies from Saudi Arabia. It was the 1980s and 1990s all over again. The consolidation of Karzai's government between 2003 and 2005 explained the timing of this Pakistani turn, Saleh judged. "What made them switch?" he asked. "Parliamentary elections? presidential elections, Afghan consensus that we will make the new order work, and the growing positive relationship of Afghanistan with India. In essence, Pakistan's generals fear that Karzai's legitimacy would steer Afghanistan toward a durable role as an Indian ally, with international backing, Saleh concluded. In a sense, both Pakistan and Afghanistan shared a dilemma. If they assumed the United States would not maintain a strong military commitment in the region for more than a few years, they had to maneuver now to construct alliances for a post-American scenario, recognizing that the region would almost certainly remain riven by the bitter conflict between India and Pakistan. Saleh's study predicted that the Taliban mobilization would intensify, and that by 2009, the guerrillas would be advancing from rural strongholds to threaten major cities like Kandahar. The paper forecast that the Taliban would mount a full-fledged insurgency that would bog down Afghan and international troops. This would turn out to be largely accurate, except that the Taliban drive on southern cities occurred even faster than that. The pyramid of the Afghanistan government's legitimacy should not be brought down due to our inefficiency in knowing the enemy, knowing ourselves, and applying resources efficiently, Saleh warned. Karzai was extremely, extremely angry about his findings. He ridiculed the predictions and asked him never again to call the Taliban an insurgency. Saleh told Karzai, "I hope time will prove me wrong, but this is a product of your intelligence service." It should be understood as an honest forecast based on independent field research. Condoleezza Rice, then Secretary of State, was the first Bush cabinet member to grasp the seriousness of Afghanistan's deterioration. Although Iraq still overwhelmingly dominated the Bush administration's national security agenda, in the spring of 2006, Rice commissioned a study of the Afghan war similar to the one Saleh had initiated. She selected David Kilcullen, a former Australian Army officer who had earned a doctoral degree studying guerrilla warfare. He was a stocky, sandy-haired man then in his late 30s, with a bounce in his step and a gift for loose, entertaining expression. Kilcullen was well aware of Amrullah Saleh's view that the Pakistanis are on the other side and they're running the war on the Taliban's behalf. Kilcullen dismissed this at the time as a convenient excuse for the NDS chief and Karzai to evade responsibility for their government's corruption and inability to consolidate authority. His view was not an isolated one at the White House or the State Department. Any endorsement of Amrullah Saleh's assessment that officers within the ISI commanded and controlled the Taliban's revival as part of official strategy endorsed by Musharraf remained an unpopular point of view in the Bush administration at the time. Kilcullen saw the Pakistani position as mainly one of weakness. He observed the awkward position the Pakistan army had been forced into in Waziristan. Tribal uprisings had taught the British Empire to maintain a light footprint there, to maintain control by providing cash subsidies from the relative safety of Peshawar. Independent Pakistan's generals were mostly ethnic Punjabis, effectively foreigners when they toured Waziristan. They had internalized Britain's lessons. Through a system of local political agents and through ISI's construction of forward operating bases during the anti-Soviet Afghan war, Pakistan had developed its own Islamism-influenced system of light presence and heavy subsidies, with an implied guarantee of autonomy for local tribes. After 2002, however, the United States had pressured Musharraf to invade Waziristan with conventional Punjabi-manned army forces. Musharraf had done so partly to assuage the Bush administration and partly to root out particular radical networks that had attempted to assassinate him. When local militants hammered the invading Pakistani troops, they forced the army into lockdown on scattered bases. Punjabi officers had to either fight or negotiate just to drive supplies down local roads. The Taliban and Waziri tribesmen had exposed the pretense of the Pakistan Army's invincibility. This left Musharraf in a complex mood by 2006. Emotional about the tactical defeats and Pakistani casualties incurred in Waziristan under American pressure, resentful of American imperiousness, cautious about further ground fighting in the tribal areas, yet willing to at least consider more military action if the United States would equip the Pakistan Army for combat success. Kilcullen traveled to Pakistan to study the war. His hosts provided him a wish list of upgraded defense and intelligence equipment they felt they needed. Some of the equipment Pakistan wanted the United States did not have, attack and transport helicopters, for example, which were in very short supply because of supply chain pressures created by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Other equipment, night vision goggles, and infrared surveillance systems, for example, were judged too sensitive to hand over to Pakistan because they could leak to enemy guerrillas or be used against India. Kilcullen landed in Pakistan in May. He took briefings at the CIA station. It remained a bastion of counter-terrorism center personnel and funding. The station had evolved into an unusual forward interagency fusion center focused substantially on terrorism. There was a large room filled with cubicles occupied by officers from the National Security Agency, who ran signals intercept operations, and the National Geospatial Agency, which controlled satellite photography. The station still staffed traditional Near East, South Asia case officers who reported on local politics and counter-proliferation specialists who followed Pakistan's nuclear program. But the counter-terrorism center had a great many positions. With Musharraf's support, the CIA had embedded officers on about half a dozen Pakistani military bases in the tribal areas. Case officers who rotated there found themselves trapped inside Pakistani facilities. Art Keller, a young case officer, rotated by helicopter to a Pakistan Army base in Waziristan during this period. An ISI colonel and two ISI majors were his liaison officers. They told him, "You can't come off this base because this is a secret base." Keller learned this was a polite fiction. The local Taliban knew the CIA and American Special Forces were present. The real reason for their confinement was to prevent the Americans from trying to operate unilaterally, and because of the genuine safety risks outside the base, where the Pakistan Army was vulnerable on the roads. Running human agents outside base perimeters to collect intelligence about militants in Waziristan remained treacherous and difficult. Every few weeks, another dead body turned up with "American spy" pinned to his chest. Most of the victims had nothing to do with the CIA, but case officers did lose a few agents. The atmosphere was deeply hostile to outsiders. Even Punjabi interpreters warned Keller that, because of their accents, they would themselves be killed if they tried to interview locals in markets or villages about sensitive subjects. That meant an effective reporting agent for the CIA had to have the right vernacular, a plausible reason to be moving around a very thinly populated region, and professional competence. They were not easy to find. The best a case officer could hope to do in many cases was to communicate by computer with agents who had access to militants. Recruiting new agents or meeting in person was difficult, and in the confines of Waziristan bases, all but impossible. During his study tour, Kilcullen heard the generalized doubts about Pakistan expressed by CIA officers in the field. Yet Bush administration policy remained firmly rooted in partnership with Musharraf. Ryan Crocker, then the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, feared that ramping up counterterrorism operations in Waziristan would blow back on Musharraf and destabilize Pakistan. And with reason. In March 2006, when a Pakistani Special Operations Task Force raided some Haqqani compounds in North Waziristan, killing Arabs and Chechens, local militants seized Pakistani government buildings in a furious and violent reaction. The operation stirred up a hornet's nest that the military was unprepared for, the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad reported. Now Kilcullen was studying how to equip and support the Pakistan Army to carry out more such operations.
Dave, I'm sitting on a powder keg here, and you're lighting matches, Crocker told Kilcullen.
Which side was Musharraf on? Even after Amrullah Saleh's tetchy encounter with General Kayani, the CIA continued to press Saleh to hand over evidence to ISI so that Pakistan could round up suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban fugitives. The assumption was that the Pakistanis would make honest use of the NDS intelligence. Kayani said so. Around the time of his study tour, NDS and the CIA's Kabul station jointly provided to ISI a list of known locations, addresses, fund details, last known position of a number of senior Taliban folks, as a senior Bush administration official involved described it. Some of the Taliban were under active surveillance. Within 48 hours, all of them moved. The Americans watched them disappear. They knew what had happened. Yet the Pakistanis just told them that their information was wrong. Kilcullen drove to Peshawar and then flew on a Pakistan Army helicopter to Waziristan. He traveled local roads in an armed convoy. His escorts included local Frontier Corps paramilitaries drawn from local Pashtun families. When he returned, a CIA officer called Kilcullen in. The officer showed him transcripts of intercepted phone calls his Frontier Corps escort had made to al-Qaeda leaders. "The American diplomat will be in your valley tomorrow if you want to kidnap them," his escort had reported. The Bush administration did not interpret the hostility of such local Pashtun enlisted men as evidence of high-level Pakistani collaboration with the Taliban, however. Because FC soldiers came from villages and tribes thoroughly infiltrated by the Taliban, their sympathies could not be relied upon. That was a historical problem that could not be fairly laid at Musharraf's feet, the thinking went. Indeed, the unreliability of the Frontier Corps was one reason Kilcullen wanted to equip Musharraf to increase regular Pakistan Army operations in the tribal areas. Kilcullen's view of Pakistani complicity darkened, however. Even if one took the maximally generous view that Musharraf was merely a victim of his state's historical weakness in the tribal areas, the Army's willingness to accept sanctuaries there and in Quetta was undeniable. Yet when Kilcullen first voiced concerns similar to Saleh's inside the administration, people laughed at me. They thought he had gone native during his visits to Afghanistan, traveling out with Afghan security forces, absorbing their conspiracy theories about ISI. The conventional wisdom in the Bush administration remained that the Pakistani position was one of weakness and ineptitude, not malice toward the American project in Afghanistan. The way to defeat terrorism in the short run is to share intelligence and to take action. It was March 2, 2006, and President George W. Bush stood bathed in sunshine in the Mughal garden of Hyderabad House in New Delhi, beside Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Bush had flown to India to ratify in public a strategic partnership based on common values that had emerged between the United States and India. The U.S.-India Civil Nuclear Agreement provided the clearest evidence that an alliance between America and India, one that might contain China's rise as a great power, had progressed beyond rhetoric. Under the accord, the Bush administration set aside objections to India's clandestine atomic bomb program and agreed to supply fuel and technology to support civilian nuclear power production. Bush signaled the end of any pretense of equivalence in American policies toward India and Pakistan. The latter would not be eligible for such nuclear assistance because Pakistan and India are different countries, as a White House fact sheet put it, and Pakistan does not have the same non-proliferation record as India, a reference to the Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan's global nuclear smuggling enterprise. Bush flew from India to Islamabad, despite the threat of terrorist attacks. To fool assassins, the Secret Service sent a decoy motorcade down Islamabad's broad streets, with Bush's protocol director, Donald Ansanat, in the president's seat.
Bush and his wife flew secretly by Black Hawk helicopter. The president's decision to trust Pakistani security at all signaled his genuine faith in Musharraf. Yet when he arrived, Bush pressured Musharraf to do more against terrorism and to accelerate a transition toward full democracy. Musharraf fumed over the Indian nuclear deal,